painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking, KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Today on Artbeat, we visit with a multifaceted theater professional. Doug Scholes Carlson is Associate Producing Director and Acting Company Member with the Great River Shakespeare Festival. We'll find out how this individual's acting career led him to opera, fight choreography, directing, and much more. You're listening to Artbeat with Terry Tenseth. Today, we are expanding on our Great River Shakespeare Festival edition, which we did last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally got you in the hot seat.
Oh, yes, that's right. You got everybody else in last year.
Yes, because you're an incredibly busy man.
Yes.
So, Doug Scholes Carlson lives in the Twin Cities,
mm-hmm.
but lives everywhere at the same time.
Yeah, well, I try and really keep a home in Minneapolis. I work in theater and opera, and the nature of that career is that you work at companies all over the country.
Well, first, let's start at the very beginning. Peel it back.
Okay.
Right, right. Childhood. Or when is it did you figure out that you wanted to be involved in theater and opera?
You know, I started doing plays when I was in either elementary school or junior high. There was a great community theater where I grew up in Northfield, Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
and really loved it. It was sometime in high school that I really thought this is what I'd love to do for a career. But I actually went to college to get a degree in computer science, and I thought I would also do theater because I thought, well, there's much better jobs in computer science, and which it turns out there are, but I couldn't get myself out of theater. Just truly love it.
Well, you can't code theater in computer science.
No. Yeah, and you get to be together with other people when you're doing theater, and usually when you're writing code, you're sort of sitting in a room yourself, and that didn't appeal to me. Yeah, I'm very glad there are people that do that, though. Yeah.
Let's talk about how you approached it educationally, you said.
Yeah, I went to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, that has a terrific theater program, great music program, great dance program, so that gave me a variety of stuff that I could learn. And, you know, also as an actor, you need a really wide background, so getting a liberal arts education is a great way to start. After I graduated from St. Olaf, I was an apprentice at the Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis, which gave me the chance to be in a professional company, see how professional actors lived, see how rehearsals worked, make a few contacts, and kind of figure out what I still had yet to learn. So after doing that for a year, then I went off to graduate school to get an MFA, a Master of Fine Arts, and I went to the Professional Actor Training Program at the University of Washington, which is a real conservatory program. We spent 16 hours a day learning to move and learning to talk and working on scripts and really just training to be an actor.
It's kind of like boot camp.
It is. It is a lot, but it's a really, I mean, if it's what you want to be doing, it's a really terrific place to be because you really spend your time intensively working on your instrument, which is your own body, and just honing your skills so that when you get out into the professional world, then you have the tools you need.
Did you have your aha moment where things clicked during that training, or was it once you were out in the real world?
You know, I think I could describe, there's any number of aha moments. I mean, along the way, you discover so many things, and there are so many points where you go, oh, now I finally get it. And those continue even to this day. I mean, even now in rehearsal for King Lear this week, there's all of a sudden things that I realize about Shakespeare or how to be as a performer that it's a constant process of growing, I think.
Well, let's talk about the diversity, because you say you do theater, but then you also do opera.
Mm-hmm.
So what led you to the opera?
Well, I had always been a singer, and going to St. Olaf, you know, of course, there's a great music tradition there. I sang in the choir there and actually briefly considered doing a master's degree in music as opposed to doing one in theater. So I'd always been a singer, really decided to go the theater route because that's what I thought I really loved. When I moved from Seattle back to Minneapolis as a young actor, basically you audition for everything.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The answer is always yes. You know, can you juggle and ride a unicycle? Yes, because by next week, I'll have learned how to do that, you know. So I auditioned for the chorus of the Minnesota Opera and got into the chorus and started singing. That was my first real exposure to opera. I'd probably only seen two operas performed in my life up to that point, but found it was an art form I really liked. And then when I was singing in the chorus, there was a fight. They were doing Verdi's Otello and needed a fight choreographer, which I do as well. So because I was already in the chorus, they hired me to do the fight, discovered that I knew how to move 60 people around the stage and could work that way. So then they brought me on as an assistant director. And then that eventually led to directing opera myself.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a
I think everybody's path in opera, especially stage directors' paths in opera, is strange. I haven't met that many stage directors in opera who really set out to be a stage director in opera. It's usually people, they were stage managers, or they were working in theater, or they were singers who moved that direction. It's usually somebody went there some oblique direction, and then you become an assistant director. And being an assistant director in opera is very different from being an assistant director in theater. In opera, the way productions work, because the sets are so big and the costumes are so complicated because everything's so expensive, usually companies will share a production, which means one set and a set of costumes and things will travel around to different companies and be staged with a different group of performers. So if you're the director of a production, then you mount the production and then you go to the next company and you mount it again, and then you go to the next company and mount it again. And what usually ends up happening is someone who has been an assistant on the production will end up mounting that production again. So being an assistant director tends to be a really good road into being a director in opera.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then you got involved in fight choreography too, right?
Yeah, I was trained as what they call an actor combatant when I was in grad school. So I had quite a bit of training in it and was pretty good at it. So I started getting hired to choreograph fights. And now that's become more and more of my career. So now I travel around the country doing that as well. A lot of the choreography I do is in opera. There are a lot of great fight choreographers out there. My specialty is really being able to take people who are not fighters at all. A lot of opera singers have no stage combat training whatsoever. And you have to train them and make them look like they know how to fight. And that's sort of where I specialize.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty fun too.
You got to learn how to fall correctly because you could really hurt yourself.
Well, the safety standards in opera traditionally, I think it's getting much better now, but traditionally in opera, the safety standards have not been that high. Productions are very, again, sets and costumes, everything's very big and very complicated, and it all gets put together very fast. So there are lots and lots of stories of people getting injured in opera. This year, I had the chance to work at Minnesota Opera on a world premiere opera, a piece called Silent Night, which is the story of the Christmas truce during World War I in, 1914. The two sides, the German and the English and the French side, spontaneously had a truce on Christmas Day. And this opera is the story of that. It's a true story. And this opera is the story of that. And of course, it opens with a huge battle scene from World War I.
Excellent.
So we've got about a 7-minute battle involving about 50 singers, guns, trench shovels, and a rotating platform.
So, oh, my.
Yeah.
So that was going to get hurt.
Yes. So they needed a fight choreographer for that. And I had the chance to work on that, which was a terrific experience.
Well, at least it's not Spider-Man, right?
Yeah. Yes. Although at times it almost felt like it with the complexity of it. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the different approach you take to directing or acting and how you approach a script. How do you dissect it and start working on your character development?
Yeah. Let's see. What should I talk about first?
Whichever one you want.
You know, it's interesting because the approach as a director and as an actor, in a way, you have to use a different part of your brain. And that's always an interesting flip for me because I will often spend a good bit of the year being a director and then I come here to Great River and then I'll switch over and be an actor. As an actor, you have to find the way to live moment by moment through what your character is going through. And in a way, you have to know only those things that your character knows. That's sort of the discipline of it, is to live that moment-to-moment thing. As a director, you need to have a bigger eye on everything. You need to make sure that the story is being told clearly to the audience, and you need to make sure that the arc of the entire piece is right for the whole audience. And in certain ways, those two different ways of thinking, each can be destructive to the other. That is, if you're an actor and you're thinking too much about the big picture and about how you're telling the story to the audience and how it's communicating and what you're trying to say with the piece as a whole, that tends not to be good for you as an actor, that you really have to stay in that moment-to-moment life. And as a director, if you get too involved with the sort of moment-to-moment life of each character, then sometimes you lose track of the big picture. And then the audience may have sort of interesting moment-to-moment stuff going on, but they don't really understand the whole story. So it's interesting that there are lots of actor directors out there. In fact, Jim Edmondson is, you know, one of the great examples of incredibly talented actor, incredibly talented director. So there are plenty of people that do both sides, but it is interesting that those two ways of thinking, you really have to shut off part of that to do the other.
Yeah, I can see that being very confusing.
Yeah, in certain ways. And in certain ways, you just have to remember what your job is when you walk into the room. You know?
So when you're going through a script as an actor, right? I mean, there's so many things you have to think about, the psychology of the character, right?
Yeah.
And the psychology of the other characters that surround it, because something character A does can affect the mentality of character B.
Yep.
right? Yeah. And then you have to work on memorization, mm-hmm. and then you have to work on actually not plotting, but...
Well, you tend to look at action.
Yeah.
I mean, as an actor, what you're really looking at is action. You're looking at an action being what I want. So what is my character going after? What am I trying to get? And how does that lead you moment to moment?
Right.
Through each thought.
Your motivating factor.
Yeah. And to a certain extent, when I first approach a script as a director, that's what I'm looking at as well. You know, you look at from every character, what is it they want? Because that's what's going to make the scenes really dynamic. If everybody on stage is truly going after something, then that's what's going to make it dynamic. The thing you need to do as a director then is you need to step back. Once you've sort of figured out how all of that works, then you need to step back one step and figure out how you're going to tell that story to an audience clearly.
Yeah. Well, like with what you're doing right now, you're doing read-throughs. Currently, right? Or are you actually at the...
Yeah, we're a little deeper into the okay. process now. We've read through the plays. Actually, both plays are sort of staged and on their feet. So we're memorized. The scripts are dropping away. We're starting to really get into the life of it where you hit this point when you first memorize the script that you know intellectually how the story progresses. So, you know, my character is going from here to here to here. This is what I'm trying to get. This is what happens in each of those scenes. But you haven't really inhabited it yet. So you're sort of making that happen a little bit mechanically. And then as you do it more and more, and as you refine your ideas, then you can begin to let go of all of those ideas. You don't have to know what the map is anymore because you're just going to follow it. Then you start to refine the life of the character. Then you start to know, why does this word lead to this word lead to this word? And when that person says that, why do I say this back? You start to feel that rather than know it intellectually. And that's kind of the process we're in right now. It's always a little bit of a frustrating part of the process to be in as an actor because you know at some point you're going to sort of tip over and then mm-hmm. you're going to be just living the life of the character. Then you feel like you're into the real work as an artist. But right now we're just on the other side of that hill and we just haven't quite tipped over yet.
Well, there's also trust that's involved in this too with you, the other members in your company.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of trust that in terms of how your scene partners are going to interact, but then also how the director has constructed the whole play. That again, if you're in that mode of an actor, then you're going to follow the path that is laid out for you, and you just have to trust that somebody else is taking care of the big picture. Luckily here at Great River, that's a pretty easy thing to do because both of the directors all three of the directors have a really good eye for telling the entire story. So you feel like, well, if what I was doing isn't working, somebody would tell me. I don't have to sort of monitor that myself.
That's an interesting process.
Mm-hmm.
It really
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
There's a lot of psychology that goes on in that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, especially when you're working in Shakespeare, there get to be so many levels of it because there's what your character says, but then there's also the structure of the language. Like, how does the verse lay out and, you know, what's the last word in the verse line and how does the rhythm lay out? And we talk about Shakespeare as having, it's got 10 syllables in a line
yeah.
and they're divided into sets of two. So you talk about each line as having 5 beats in it, but sometimes there's a line that has 5.5 and sometimes there's one that has 6 or sometimes there's fewer. And why does that happen that way? The character that I'm playing in King Lear, Edgar, by my research on the text, there's a number of cases where the word that Edgar has chosen to use in a particular case is the first example of that word being used in the English language.
Mm.
And that happens all the time in Shakespeare. But then you say, well, he's choosing an incredibly specific word. He might be making up a word at this moment to express an idea that no one has expressed before. And there gets to be a lot to that. Why is this moment so important that he would make up a word that no one has ever heard of before? Yeah.
I think I've been there.
Yes. Yeah. 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 I know. Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
So what's your favorite part of the whole process? Is it the coming together with everybody and doing the read through? Is it the actual molding or is it the performance?
Oh boy, I don't know how to answer that question. There are things that I truly love about each part of that process. I think that's why I like coming back to it over and over again, is because each moment along the way, I mean, I love that moment when you finally first get in front of the audience, but then that moment is always so fraught with a lot of nerves. And then eventually, once you've done the show a few more times, then you start to settle into it. Then you start to communicate with the audience on a different level. I mean, the moment of that first reading is always exciting because inevitably you discover something that you didn't think of when you were just working on the script on your own. And it's that moment of doing the first reading is so full of potential and so full of terror because you realize all the things that you've got to do in the next while.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, there's so many points along the process that are just, that are so much fun. It's a good job to have.
Excellent. Now, you've probably worked on a variety of things. Like, can you give us an example of extreme different types of productions you've been in?
Yeah, gosh. Well... Let's see. Well, as an actor, I mean, last year, just before I came down here, I was involved in a play about the genocide in Bosnia. Mm. So I was playing as a very realistic script that also had this dance elements to it that were incredibly non-realistic. So I was working on that and then, you know, sort of tipped right over into the world of being a fairy in A Midsummer Night's Dream that was essentially an entirely movement-based character. The character I was playing in Henry IV was almost entirely grounded in the text. There's always something very different going on.
Is your favorite Shakespeare, or is there a different genre that you
I think my favorite really is Shakespeare. Okay. It's great to have the chance to work on contemporary drama because you deal with issues that are sort of fresh and that are things that are happening to us right now. It's seldom that you get to a script that surprises you as many times as a script by Shakespeare will. You know, if you're working on Shakespeare, that, you know, you're going to have done 50 performances of something and you feel like you know it inside and out. And all of a sudden, you're going to realize what one line actually means. Mm-hmm. You're just going to realize that there's so much more depth to that. I actually think in a lot of ways, opera can have that same thing. And I know I directed a production of Lucia di Lammermoor this year, the Donizetti opera. And it's what they call bel canto opera. And bel canto opera means that it really is going to lead from the voice. It's about beautiful singing. So it gets the reputation that the text doesn't mean anything. And the text very often is repetitive. Like you'll sing something and then there'll be a repeat, so they just use the same text again. And the thing we discovered in that is what was happening in the music was actually telling a clear story that made you realize there was a whole lot more going on than what was just existing in the language. Mm. So I don't know. I think it's those moments that I really value as an artist, those things where something surprises you and you realize it's so much bigger than what you thought it was. It encompasses so much more of the human experience than you thought it was going to.
It's revelation to you, or like an epiphany in a way.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. In a way. And, you know, I always tell my students when I'm teaching, you know, the reason that we create a work of art in many ways is, you know, we all exist inside of our own experience, and we have no way of knowing whether anybody else's experience matches that. That I say, you know, I know what it is to love. I love my wife. You know, I know what that means to me, but I don't know what that means to anybody else. But when you see Romeo on stage, when you see Lear with his daughters, when you see, you know, what my character Edgar does for his father in the play, then you say, yeah, that. I've been through that. I've experienced that. Somebody who lived 400 years ago knows exactly what it is to be a human being. And other people in this theater know that too. And it's that moment that we really understand that we have this shared experience. And I think you can't get that in any other way except mm-hmm. through a work of art.
And art reflects life. So, I mean, it's full circle.
It does. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the whole point in any kind of art, is in some way to express, to reflect somebody's experience of what it is to be a human being.
Yeah. Now, teaching, mm-hmm. do you learn more from the students than you think that they learn from you?
Yeah, very often. You learn so much about your own process, like what you do, and you learn a lot about how you see the world, like your biases in terms of how you see the world by encountering people that see it completely differently. I taught at St. Olaf College the year before last, and I taught a Shakespeare class there, and it was just, you know, their take on the play. We were working in depth on Hamlet, and their take on that play was so different from my own, because they're at a completely different point in their life. You know, they saw things that I didn't see, and didn't see things that I thought were really important. So, yeah. It's pretty fascinating.
It's a little bit more of a personal question for you. Embarrassing moments in theater.
Oh, gosh. I've had some embarrassing moments in theater. Well, actually, the all-time worst I think I ever had, I was out at the Utah Shakespeare Festival. We were doing a Gilbert and Sullivan opera, and I was playing the tenor lead in it, and he has this aria. We were doing Mikado, and he has this aria when he starts out and comes to a big high note at the end. And Utah being what it is, it's very dry out there, and you can never get enough water, and I cracked that note just full on, like,
aah! Did you own it?
I did. Yep. Yeah. Okay. My character was a little bit goofy, so you can kind of get away with it. And, you know, and you can make a joke out of it, and you can sort of make the audience think that, well, maybe he intended to do that. But yeah, the cast was merciless backstage afterwards.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I can't live it down, can you?
Yeah.
Well, it's about overcoming it, too, when it happens on stage and what you can make of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we all have those moments where you just, you know, the line is just gone from your head, and you're just all of a sudden utterly terrified out there.
And that's when you hope your castmates lead you to that.
You hope that they, you hope that they help you find your way out of it. It's what makes it fun, though. I mean, that sort of standing on the cliff's edge, you know. You know, we say break a leg in this country when you go on stage. That means good luck. And the Italians say in bocco al lupo. And that's what you say often in operas, in bocco al lupo, into the wolf's mouth or into the mouth of the wolf. So that's sometimes what it feels like.
Have you ever been in a production where the audience just was not having it?
Yeah, actually, I toured a production of Hamlet. I had my own company in Minneapolis called Minnesota Shakespeare Project, and I also toured it with the Utah Shakespeare Festival. And we went into a lot of schools, and we'd go into schools and community centers and things like that and perform. We were really doing Shakespeare for people that were not used to seeing Shakespeare. And boy, there were some of those audiences that you just couldn't win over. You know, that mm-hmm. were just not having it. Some of the time, you know, you'd go in and they weren't having it at the beginning, and then you'd keep doing the play and stick with it, and then they'd really come around, and other times you just couldn't win.
So what do? You just keep going?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed the process of having to use the language and having to really own it. I mean, that you were either going to make sense of it or you weren't. They weren't just going to be polite about it. If they weren't enjoying it, they weren't going to be polite. I mean, that's really fun, and it's a much more honest experience. And I'm sure they probably actually got a lot more out of it for having been honest about it than that, you know, we're not interested, we don't care. They probably got more out of it than sort of sitting there politely.
If you weren't doing this, what would you be doing?
If I wasn't doing a career in the theater?
Yeah.
I don't honestly know. I don't know. Maybe I'd be in politics. Maybe I'd be a lawyer or something. I'd probably be in politics. I'd probably be working on some kind of social cause or something. But I really don't know. Theater is not the kind of profession you go into if you have anything else that you think would make you happy.
Right.
You wouldn't be in theater. You'd go do that, because there's anything else is going to be an easier life. In terms of your family, in terms of earning money, in terms of all of that, probably politics, yeah.
Do you feel like you've had to struggle at all at any point in your career?
I've been really lucky. I can't remember the last time that I had a job that was really not theater related. And I do a wide variety of stuff. I mean, some of it is filming a commercial or doing an industrial video, or I do some administrative work for a Great River Shakespeare Festival. But it's all sort of in the world of theater. So I feel pretty lucky. I mean, you work pretty hard, you work really long hours, and you're constantly scrambling for the next job. And that's the part that is probably the most wearing, is that when you've got a job, you've got to be thinking ahead of what your next one is. Because it doesn't matter how successful you're being at the job you're doing, you're going to get fired at the end of it because the play is going to close. So
right.
You have to find the next thing.
And you're a family man, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. And your wife understands your career.
Well, she's a violinist. Yeah. So she is in the same kind of world. I mean, she has a teaching studio, so she's got at least, you know, that sort of thing keeps on going regularly. And then she's part of an orchestra that keeps on bringing her back. But, you know, you're still always just looking for the next opportunity. I mean, I count myself lucky because I think I'm part of a generation that can actually do what we do, which is to be a theater artist, to own a house, to have a family, to have a semi-normal life. I think a generation back, that wasn't possible at all. The regional markets like Minneapolis and Chicago and a couple of other places just didn't exist on a level where you could expect to do that. So actors would go to New York, and then you would audition in New York, and then you would go out places to do theater. And it was such a transient lifestyle that you just really couldn't have a family.
You're a gypsy.
Yeah. 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 In a lot of ways. This past year, I ended up traveling a lot, but it's the first time in my career that I've really felt like I had to go out and travel around. I've mostly been able to work in one place, which is a real gift.
What do you think about the current generation of students that are coming out into the field?
Well, I think it's going to be interesting for them, because I think what they're going to discover is that they have to be much more entrepreneurial even than like my generation. And I think we were that much more entrepreneurial than the generation before, that as an artist, you have to promote yourself. You have to create your own work. That's just the way that it is. The nice thing now is that you have all the tools available to do that, between social media and being online and things like that. You can communicate really effectively with an audience. It is possible to create your own work. I mean, you know, witness Great River Shakespeare Festival, which we created from nothing 9 years ago. I think that is going to be more and more what you do in a career in the theater, is that you treat yourself even more like a business. You don't sort of sit around waiting for someone to hire you, but you go out and create the work that you want to do.
And I think with the social media, it it almost seems like there'd be more people out there making it more of a challenge, you know, because now you could just got this buffet of people you can pick from.
Well, it's one more skill that you have to have, that somebody who is really good at networking and keeping in touch with people and creating work and doing stuff like that is going to be able to find work. But that's not necessarily the same skill as being an actor or being a director. Or so now it's one other level of skill that might sort of be the price of admission to being part of the profession.
Have you already encountered your dream role, or is there something out there that you are just itching to do or direct?
You know, I have always wanted to play, Henry V. So that's one that I have not gotten to yet. I did get a chance to play Hamlet once that I hope that someday I'll get another crack at that one, because obviously it's a role that you can keep on exploring and exploring and exploring. The role I'm playing right now in King Lear actually has been one of them on my list for a long time. I'm playing Edgar in King Lear. And I played the role right after I graduated from college, from undergrad. And it was my first real experience in a major Shakespearean production and playing sort of a major Shakespearean role. And I knew all the way through, the whole time I was doing it, I knew that I was missing so much. I knew I was just scratching the surface of it. And I had been dying, and this is, 20 years ago now. And I've been dying to do it again ever since. So this is one of them. I mean, they sort of keep on coming along.
What about for directing?
I really want to do another production of Cymbeline. I did one here at Great River Shakespeare Festival with the Apprentice Company, and I'd love to do another production of Cymbeline. In the opera world, I would love to take on, I'm hoping to get the chance to take on some of the big classics. The opera world is funny because you end up doing the same productions over and over again, and people get a little bit sick of them. So sometimes you come around to Carmen and La Boheme and The Barber of Seville and these sort of really famous pieces, and people get a little bit jaded about them. But I'm actually really looking forward to getting to take on that. I got to do Lucia de Lammermoor, which is one of the big classics. But yeah, I'd love to do a Bohème. I'd love to do a Carmen. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
So what do you do for hobbies then? What does Doug Scholes Carlson do for a hobby?
You know, I was actually thinking about this recently. I don't really have a hobby because so much of what I do ends up sort of funneling back in. I mean, I'm a runner now in the last 2 years. Yeah. So that is probably my biggest hobby that is unrelated to, I mean, it's related to being an actor because obviously you have to be in shape and everything like that, but it's essentially unrelated. And I've been really loving that. I ran my first marathon this year.
Excellent.
Yeah, ran the Twin Cities Marathon on a day that I had two performances of Hamlet at the Jungle Theater. Yeah.
Yes. It's totally knocked that out.
Somehow managed to survive that. So it was actually very funny. I was training as a runner, and I thought my goal was to just an under 4 hour marathon.
Right.
Because I think that's a respectable marathon.
That's a respectable goal.
And the way the time laid out, I had a 2 o'clock matinee of Hamlet, and the marathon started at 8 o'clock, the Twin Cities Marathon, and ended in downtown St. Paul. So fight call was going to be at 1 o'clock. So essentially, I had to run a 4 hour marathon.
Like, I have no choice.
It was just going to have to happen. So
is there another one you're planning on doing?
You know, I haven't decided yet. I kind of think I should do the Twin Cities Marathon again, because I think if I don't do it again next year, then it might be one of those things that I just never do again.
Oh, right.
Like, you just sort of fall out of shape and then you never do it again.
And you have to work your way up with running. Like, that's not something you can just take off and start doing.
Yeah. Although at this time last year, I was in much worse shape than I am right now.
Uh-huh.
So I managed to ramp up. So by October, then I was ready to run the marathon.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'd love to do Trinona some year. In fact, I tried to get together. Yeah, I tried to get together. We were going to do a relay team from Great River Shakespeare Festival. We couldn't quite bring it together. Eric Paulson, who has been our technical director and our set designer, you know, used to be a semi-professional mountain bike racer.
Whoa.
So we thought, well, we need him on the bicycle. And then I thought I could run, and then we have to find
a swimmer.
And Eric Paulson is not with us this season. He took a new job, so he's not with us this season. Yeah, he'll be back with us again, I'm sure. And then we'll have a team for the Trinona.
You can do it. You can totally do it. Yeah. It's doable. If I can do it, you guys can do it.
Well, I'm figuring as a team, then you only have to run like 10 miles and, you know, I mean, it's not that bad.
Or you could do the sprint course too.
Oh, yeah, really. Right.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Because I'm too chicken to do Garvin Heights.
Oh, the sprint course doesn't go up Garvin Heights. Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was what was scaring me off, too, from the biking part of it. It's like, I'm not riding up that hill. I've biked up it just as a, you know, just as an individual for like bike over, bike up it. And that was about it for the day.
You're
you know,
I'm done.
That's plenty of workout.
Winona's great. for scenery and for recreational sports, which I'm sure you everybody in the company probably loves.
Yeah.
But yeah, that hill is nasty.
Yeah. Well, I keep thinking too, as the Shakespeare Festival gets bigger and bigger, I think the rest of Minnesota is really going to discover Winona.
I do too.
You know, I grew up in Northfield and I had never been over to this part of the state.
But
I just had no idea.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we drove through, like if you're driving to Chicago, you would drive through and sort of say, oh, the bluffs are really pretty here. But that was about it. Not realizing how beautiful the kayaking is and the canoeing. And I mean, it's the best mountain biking in the state, I think. I mean, I know people go to the North Shore, but I really think the mountain biking is better down here. Well, and then you go just across the river, the road biking is, I mean, that's, there's no better place in the country to go road biking.
No, not at all. Well, have we covered all your dreams and aspirations in life?
Yeah, gosh, I don't know. We'll have to do a, I think so.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
A big thank you goes out to Doug Scholes Carlson for visiting with us on Art Beat. More information on this interesting and talented individual can be found at dougscholescarlson.wordpress.com. That's Doug, scholzcarlson.wordpress.com. More information on the Great River Shakespeare Festival can be found at grsf.org. You've been listening to Art Beat.
Art Beat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.